Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, coming to you from the studios of KPFT Houston since 2002. Houston's community station, 90.1 FM, FM HD1, Galveston 89.5 FM, and Huntsville 91.9 FM. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. This show is syndicated and it airs on other radio stations in different cities in the US and Europe. During this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1129, I will talk about the ongoing Israeli genocide, slaughter, and ethnic cleansing in occupied Palestine, including the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. I will also air a recording of an event organized by the Council on American Islamic Relations titled Muslim Resignees Speak, How Islamophobia and Anti-Palestinian Racism Fuel Biden Administration's Gaza Policy. It has been nearly 11 months since apartheid Israel started escalating at an unprecedented levels its ongoing genocide and ethnic cleansing against the Palestinians, which started over 76 years ago and not on October 7, 2023. What we have been witnessing 24/7 since October 7 is the mother of terrorism, the mother of war crimes, the mother of genocide, the mother of atrocities committed by the mother of apartheid, Israel, funded and supported by a few Western countries, but mainly the United States. Since October 7, 2023, apartheid Israel murdered more than 40,000 Palestinians in the destroyed and occupied Gaza Strip, nearly half of them children and women. More than 100,000 were wounded. Tens of thousands are still missing under the rubble. Everything in the Gaza Strip, where 2.3 million Palestinians live, was targeted and destroyed, including hospitals, clinics, ambulances, schools, universities, places of worship, including mosques and churches, businesses, malls, supermarkets, grocery stores, bakeries, manufacturers, water purification stations, power plants, residential buildings, apartment complexes, I mean everything. Apartheid Israel is not even keeping it a secret. Its leaders have repeatedly said that is their plan, and it is televised 24/7 to the world that has ignored what is going on there. Apartheid Israel continues to enjoy full impunity for all its atrocities and war crimes, and it decided it is a golden opportunity to also escalate its attacks on the Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. And for the past few months, and especially over the past few days, Israeli occupation soldiers started destroying the infrastructure in several cities and refugee camps in the West Bank, kidnapping dozens of Palestinians, shooting and killing hundreds, including children, demolishing Palestinian homes, raiding banks and money exchange places and stealing the money inside them, and even burning Palestinian homes and cars. None of these war crimes will ever stop as long as apartheid Israel continues to receive arms, money, support, impunity, and protection from the United States. If you wonder how could the United States support such atrocities and war crimes? Well, first of all, the U.S. has a long history of settler colonialism, so it should be no surprise that it is supporting a settler colonial project, Israel. What I would like to do now is share with you a recording of an event the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE, the largest Muslim civil rights and advocacy organization in the United States, held on August 28, 2024, titled Muslim Resignees Speak, How Islamophobia and Anti-Palestinian Racism Fuel Biden Administration's Gaza Policy. During that virtual event, former U.S. Interior Department official Maryam Hassanein and former State Department diplomat Hala Rareed spoke with CARE National Deputy Director Edward Ahmed Mitchell and Robert McCow, Director of Government Affairs at CARE. Let's listen to their conversation and one of the questions and answer that followed. And this is the voice of Edward Ahmed Mitchell, CARE National Deputy Director.
What I want to start by noting is the following. You have watched, and we have watched, over the past 10 months, a genocide unfolding on our phones. We have seen the Israeli government use American taxpayer dollars, American-provided weapons to massacre civilians in Gaza, to render most of Gaza uninhabitable, to kill at least 40,000 men, women, and children, if not more. And they've done all that with the support of our government here in the United States, diplomatic support, financial support, military support. And it's important to note that what the Israeli government did should not have been a surprise. Just days after October 7th, the Israeli president said out loud, there are no innocent civilians in Gaza. It's a myth that there are innocent civilians in Gaza. The Israeli defense minister said that they were cutting off all food, fuel, water, and electricity to Gaza because they were fighting, quote unquote, human animals. And Netanyahu himself, the prime minister, analogized what they were going to do in Gaza to a biblical story about the kingdom of Israel wiping out every man, woman, child, infant, and ox in an ancient kingdom of Amalek. So we knew what they were going to do, and they spent 10 months doing it, and they're still doing it to this very day. In response to these war crimes, at least a dozen officials have resigned from the Biden administration, including members of the State Department and other agencies. Those officials had various reasons for stepping down. Some, it was their conscience. They just could not be part of the administration while doing this. Some did not want to violate the law. Some wanted to be able to speak up publicly about what was happening. For some, it was all the above. Today, we're going to hear from two very unique and special leaders, people who are well experienced in government, people who are American Muslims, and people who bravely stepped down early this year and spoke out publicly about it and are here today. Not only tell us about why they stepped down, but to tell us about the ways in which anti-Muslim bigotry and anti-Palestinian racism have influenced our government policy. Because we've all been asking why. Why would our government support these war crimes? Why would our government flout the law for 10 months? And sadly, part of the answer is anti-Muslim bigotry, anti-Palestinian racism, its influence on U.S. policy in the Middle East, and the dehumanization that causes of the people of Gaza. So we're going to learn about that today. We're going to hear about this inside perspective on these issues. And we hope that shedding a light on these problems, on this bigotry, will eventually lead to a change in policy so that we never have to have a conversation like this again. We never have to sit here and speak to government officials to ask why they had to resign and protest of a genocide. Let this be the last time we ever have to do this, God willing. So with that, let me turn over to Robert McCall to introduce our guests. Robert, take it away.
Thank you so much, Edward. Assalamu alaikum, everyone. I had the pleasure of introducing our two speakers here with us today, former Biden administration resignees. The first speaker, I'm going to read her bio right here. It's Maryam Hassanein. She served as a political appointee in the Biden administration at the Department of Interior, where she was a special assistant to the Assistant Secretary for Land, Minerals, and Management. Inspired by the student movement, she resigned on July 2nd, 2024, in opposition to the administration's handling of the Israel-Gaza conflict and its harmful impact on Palestinians. She is the youngest to resign so far and the first Muslim appointee to resign. Prior to joining the administration, she worked on Capitol Hill in a Democratic member's office, managing a diverse portfolio that included environment and energy, religious liberty, and international human rights. She holds a BS in Justice Studies with a minor in Social Welfare for Arizona State University. Thank you very much, Marion. Also, we have Hala Rahit, and she is a former career American diplomat with a deep experience in the Middle East. She joined the Foreign Service in 2006 as a political officer with notable assignments, including political and human rights officer at the U.S. Embassy in Sana'a, Yemen. She was a deputy chief of the political economic section at the U.S. Embassy in Doha, Qatar, and a political economic chief at the U.S. consulate in Durban in South Africa. Most recently, she served as an Arabic language spokesperson for the State Department at the regional media hub at the U.S. consulate in Dubai in the UAE. In April 2024, Ms. Rahit became the first American diplomat to publicly resign in protest of the Biden administration's Gaza policy, condemning it as a failed, illegal, and inhuman militaristic strategy. She's earned a master's degree from Georgetown University Walsh School of Foreign Service, concentrating in Arab studies, and an undergraduate degree in international relations and Middle Eastern studies from George Washington University's Elliott School. Thank you both for joining us. And with that, I'm going to hand it back over to Edward to ask the first question.
Thank you, Robert. And thank you to Robert and everyone for helping to bring this event together. And again, thank you all for joining us today for this discussion. So Hala, let me begin with you. And I want to dive right into it. What was the tipping point? You know, what was the tipping point that led you to publicly resign from your role as an American diplomat, most recently serving in the Middle East? Was there a specific event or policy that solidified this decision or a snowball effect? Just tell us why.
Well, first of all, thank you so much, Edward, for hosting this and to CARE for putting this together, and to Miriam, really, who had the wonderful idea to get us all together. There was no particular tipping point, honestly. It was a devastating day-to-day continuation of the same failed policy that eventually left me absolutely helpless and hopeless. And that is the very first time in my 18-year diplomatic career that I have ever felt that. Obviously, as an American diplomat, there are times when there are disagreements about policies, but I've never felt that I haven't been able to advocate or give my professional opinion. That was different this time. So for me, it was really twofold. First and foremost, the policy, and that's the primary issue. And as an American diplomat, I signed an oath when I joined the Foreign Service to defend the Constitution, to uphold the law, to advance American interests. And this policy was fundamentally opposed to that. And in my particular latest role as spokesperson, as you mentioned, for the Arab world, I was documenting on a daily basis what Pan-Arab media was covering. And I was sending daily reports back to the department. And what these daily reports were showing was basically U.S. complicity. One, they were showing the devastation of what was unfolding day to day, because my job was to consolidate what Arab audiences were consuming. And that was, in essence, in order to help the department formulate strategic communications. To be clear, there was never a strategic communication. I was in that office that was supposed to compose strategic communication. It was never that. It was the same talking points as we've all been hearing for the past 10 months, despite evidence, not just from me, through these daily reports, through classified reporting, through countless other reporting from embassies and consulates throughout the Middle East and North Africa, the policy wouldn't shift. And for me, seeing the complicity, and even when department officials recognized the complicity, there was no ability to shift the policy. I knew that there was really no way for me to remain. I began personally to feel complicit. I refused to do interviews on Gaza. Again, not because I personally disagreed with it, but because I was documenting on a daily basis what our messaging strategy, or lack thereof, and what our policy was doing. And what it was doing is increasing anti-American sentiment. It was destabilizing the Middle East, and it was not helping anyone. Obviously, it was devastating to the Palestinians, but it was also a threat to Israeli security. There is no way that 20,000 orphans in Gaza will ensure a secure Israel. I could go on and on in terms of the policy, but when I realized that our ambassadors, when I realized that our assistant secretaries, all career diplomats, were basically voiceless, that the policy would remain because it was being controlled directly from the top. That's when I knew, despite my efforts to try to push back against the policy and inform and help the department, I basically realized there's no way I can maintain, and decided to submit my resignation. Now, that's the policy. Another issue that I have not discussed as publicly since I've resigned is what I personally experienced, and the Islamophobia that I experienced, the anti-Arab racism that I experienced. So I was systematically sidelined. I was kept out of meetings. I was kept out of projects, things that were meant to be my job. I was forced to no longer be part of. And that's because I was vocal about the policy. But the issue here is that diplomats are always vocal about policy, but I was being dismissed because I was of Arab origin. And that honestly has never happened to me in my 18-year career. I was being dismissed because of my religious affiliation, which has never really been an issue. And I've never really discussed it. You know, when you get to work, you get to work and you do your job, especially as an American diplomat, that becomes your identity. Without getting into too many details, and I'm happy to answer questions, but without getting into too many details, there were a lot of actions taken against me. HR actions, other actions. I was told, because I was, again, insisting that these interviews on Gaza to Arab media were not helping the United States. They were actually hurting us, and I was documenting that. I was told, quote unquote, diversity should not mean you don't get to do your job. I was often referred to because you're an Arab woman. And honestly, I was no longer willing to work in that type of environment. And what was the most disappointing was, despite the fact that I reported this repeatedly and I went through the official chains, nothing was done about it. And to me, that is not the State Department we should be. It's not the State Department that I've known throughout my career, but it is the State Department of today. And it didn't just happen to me. It's happening to countless others that have come to me and have shared their stories with me of Arab descent, Muslims, but also others that are critical of the policy. It has become, are you with us or against us? That's not how a democratic administration is supposed to function. So again, I haven't discussed that part so much publicly because it's really the policy that is catastrophic. It's the failed policy. It is an ongoing genocide, and we are complicit in it, and that must end. But since, honestly, the DNC, for me, and seeing how Arab voices, Palestinian voices, Muslim voices were silenced so much, I realized that myself, within my own mind, there's a normalization to Islamophobia. I've almost convinced myself it's okay that I went through that. It's almost accepted. It's almost normalized. And the reason why I'm discussing it today is because it should not be normalized. No one should be okay with that. And it is a detriment to our country, and it's a detriment to our own policymaking. So I'll stop there for now.
No, thank you, Hala, for sharing all of that, including some of the personal experience you had. And we're going to get into that in more detail. I want to back up a little bit. You know, what inspired you to pursue a career in public service in the first place, particularly focused in diplomacy? And, you know, how did your experiences as an American Muslim kind of shape your views on U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East in particular? Does it have any effect at all? So just take us back a little bit about, you know, your perspective when you first joined the State Department.
Sure. So honestly, as silly as it may sound, it was love for country. It really was. And it continues to be. This is why I'm actually still speaking out, is love for country. And I had a deep sense of service that I wanted to serve. And I deeply, strongly believe in the power of diplomacy. I believe that violence begets violence. And for the vast majority of conflicts, diplomacy is the solution, and that's why I chose a diplomatic career. You know, my family immigrated to the United States from Morocco when I was a little girl, and I was raised with pride of what it meant to be an American. I was raised with pride in American values of human rights, freedom of speech, liberty for all. You know, this was embedded within me as an immigrant, as an Arab American, as a Muslim American. And even though I was of Moroccan descent, there was a lot of turbulence between U.S. And the Middle East, most particularly the Iraq War. You know, it was a very formative time in my period. Morocco's very far from Iraq. But, you know, once you're in the U.S. and you're Arab, it sort of all mixes in. So I was naturally asked a lot of questions by some friends. And it basically led me to become a diplomat very young. Because I was, you know, I had to represent somewhat. And I really felt that I could contribute. I could contribute because I spoke the language. I could contribute because I had some knowledge of the history of the region, and I felt like I should serve. And to the second part of your question is, how did it serve me? Up to this conflict, quite honestly, it served me very well. And it was embraced by the State Department, and it really opened up doors for me. for one, I want to say it was never a primary issue, right? As an American diplomat, like I said, I'm an American diplomat. That's it. But I did, at least in the Middle East, I did speak the language. I spoke Arabic. And I'll have to say as well, Muslims weren't dehumanized in my eyes. I treated my counterparts, whether I served in Yemen or Qatar, with respect. They weren't dehumanized in my mind as they were with some. I'm not going to, you know, I don't want to speak about the State Department as a monolith. And I want to say that diplomats are incredible people. But there are some, right, that dehumanize the other. That was never an issue for me. And that really opened up doors. It allowed me to have a very successful diplomatic career where I was able to launch multiple bilateral initiatives that were very successful and continue to be successful today. Even in South Africa, obviously not in the Middle East, but even South Africa, when I served there as political economic chief, South Africans did not forget to this day that we supported the apartheid regime. But I was able to relate to my South African counterparts on a very humane and human level, and it opened up doors for me. Again, it was a benefit, and it was embraced up until this particular conflict.
Last question for you before we take a break and move over to Robert and Miriam to discuss her perspectives and experiences. You know, tell us exactly how you saw Islamophobia and anti-Palestinian racism manifesting in the U.S. government's approach, the way the U.S. government was responding to Gaza or the West Bank or claims of Israeli human rights abuses and war crimes targeting Palestinians. You know, what impact behind the scenes was anti-Palestinian racism or Islamophobia having on U.S. policy?
Well, to be quite honest, I saw it from the very beginning through our talking points. Again, I was a spokesperson for the department in the region, and I was supposed to be one of the faces of this policy in the Arab world. But when I read the talking points, I would literally say, are you kidding me? Did somebody actually write this and expects me to say this in front of Arab media? There is no way, because there was an inherent dehumanization of Palestinians in the language, right? For one, at the very beginning of the conflict, they weren't even mentioned in our talking points. It was Israel has a right to defend itself, which that is an expected American policy. But when you juxtapose it with images of massacres, and that was from the very beginning, we completely, as a department, initially omitted that. There was a lot of pushback from the field. You have to recognize the plight of the Palestinians. The fact that we even had to say that, the fact that we as diplomats even had to advocate for that, is insane. You'll remember very early on, President Biden questioned the number of Palestinians killed in Gaza. This is in direct contradiction to U.S. government experts who from the start have always stipulated, even publicly, that the number is likely higher than that is reported by the Gaza Health Ministry. But that narrative was pushed, and it was a dehumanizing narrative. Another concrete example that I'll give is, I'm not sure if you all recall, you can Google it, 100 days after the conflict, there was an official message that came out of the department, 100, and it came from Secretary Blinken, and it was, you know, 100 days post-conflict, but it strictly referred to the Israeli hostages. Of course, we need to recognize the plight of the innocent Israeli hostages that were taken captive. That is absolutely horrific, and the statement should have emphasized their humanity without a doubt. What was shocking was there was no mention 100 days post-conflict of Palestinians. Not a single mention. And again, as spokespeople, we were supposed to be amplifying these messages coming from Washington to Arab media. And I made the point, how are you writing a 100-day message without even mentioning the word Palestinian? And there was, we forgot. I'm not kidding you. We forgot. We didn't think about it. So what does that tell us? That is, it is even at the subconscious level, the level of dehumanization. How can you forget tens of thousands of people that are being massacred? Not only are they being massacred, but they're being massacred with our bombs. So you are choosing willfully to ignore their humanity. They don't exist. I could go on and on with example after example. but it can, I hope you're getting the sense that it was embedded throughout the policy. And obviously is also what led me to resign.
Absolutely. We'll get into more detail, more examples soon. I want to turn to Robert and Miriam to begin their discussion. And let's hear a bit about what Miriam experienced and her perspectives, an official at the Department of Interior. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm really honored to just ask these questions. Miriam, you were one of the few Muslim appointees in the Biden administration. What specific factors or events led to your decision to resign from the Biden administration? At any point, was there a particular moment that it crystallized, you realized that resignation was just necessary?
Thank you, first of all, for CARE, for hosting this. And I would say, you know, I initially joined the administration because I did believe that I would lend a hand in pursuing justice for marginalized communities across the country. And what I saw take place is that month after month, there were these great injustices through the administration's unconditional support of Israel while they are committing these mass atrocities in Gaza. And it really came to a point where I was being negatively impacted on a personal level, as I'm sure, you know, all or most of us on this call have been seeing the atrocities broadcast on our phones, on our televisions. And, you know, I think we have the privilege of looking away, but the Palestinians in Gaza don't. So, you know, I think that it came to a point where I was finding it incredibly difficult to be motivated by and to celebrate the good work that is being done at Interior and just on a domestic level, because it was being overshadowed and offset by the US's support of Israel during this time. And I would say that the moment that really kind of solidified that I'm going to resign was seeing the student movement come to life, which I've been vocal about having had that play a really big part in my resignation. You know, seeing that come to life, especially in Washington, D.C. at George Washington University, you know, these students who they saw crackdowns take place at Columbia and other universities, and still, despite of that, knew that they had to make their voices heard and knew that they had to call for divestment because they didn't want, you know, to be associated and to have their school associated with Israel's atrocities in Gaza. And, you know, I was just really inspired by such a great display of sacrifice. And I then looked at what I should be doing. And like those students who were and who felt and continue to feel unwillingly associated with the genocide and Palestinian oppression, I also felt, you know, this unwilling complicity as I think, honestly, across the country as a whole. I think all of us living in this country are unwillingly complicit in what is going on. And then I also just, I recognize that if these students who, you know, have a lot to lose can put things on the line and advocate, then I too, as someone who, you know, who's in the workforce, who especially is in public service and in the administration, should also advocate and should also, you know, reject being associated, having my labor associated with the genocide in any way.
The students continue to inspire so many Americans. You know, tens of thousands protested, 2,000 were arrested, and yet they're all coming back to campus this fall. And I think they're going to continue to inspire Americans with their peaceful protests. You know, you yourself as a student, you had a focus on, you had a BS in justice studies and you minored in social welfare. So you had a center of justice in your own studies. And then when you went to Capitol Hill, you focus on environmental energy, but you also had a portfolio of religious liberty, international human rights.